My name is Jeanette Winterson, and I'm a writer, and this is Susie Orbach, who I'm sure, as you all know, is a writer and psychoanalyst. And when I was approached by Michael Morris of Archangel to see who I wanted to talk to this morning to begin this long conversation, I really wanted to talk to Susie Orbach because I first started reading her in 1979, and I'd gone up to Oxford to do an English course, which I thought was pretty comprehensive because it was meant to be from Beowulf to Beckett. But what they forgot about completely was all the women. There was a spooky absence of women, either as writers or thinkers, people with ideas. And at the same moment, in a sort of cataclysm of realisation, I found Adrienne Rich, the American poet and essayist, and Susie Orbach, who'd just written Fat is a Feminist Issue, which is such a commonplace of thought now. Everybody knows the book, everybody knows what she was talking about, the idea of bringing body image, the way we think about ourselves, particularly as women, into the common culture, how we're manipulated about size, about sexuality. But nobody had done that. It wasn't just that it hadn't happened in feminism, it hadn't happened at all. So it was absolutely new ground. And as often, the place that is new ground then becomes the place which is central to discourse. And Susie's new book is Bodies, which you may or may not have read, but you should, which is really looking at where we've got to now with our bodies and with our self-image in our culture. And one of the things I wanted to say to Susie, I wanted to ask her about, is how now, I don't know if you feel this, but I feel that things have improved in society in many ways, that we are more tolerant of diversity, of difference, that particularly in the family, all of us now have different ways of understanding familial relationships. It doesn't have to be nuclear anymore. We're comfortable with single parents, we're comfortable with gay parents, we're comfortable with people who live together, people who have children, people who don't. So there's been a kind of relaxing, which I think is good, which is a general tolerance. And I thought that things were improving, but when I look now at the state of body image, when I look at the way that both the cosmetic industry and the food industry continues to manipulate ideas of women, I wonder why we are so intolerant about different body size, different body shape, particularly for women, why we all aspire to this notion of perfect size, perfect thinness. And I think I mentioned to you that I saw a programme on telly, The Awful Loose Women, where there'd been some model who'd appeared in the paper. She was only in her 20s, she was gorgeous, and she had a little tum. She just looked fantastic, but normal. And all the women on this wretched television programme were saying, that's disgusting, I don't want to look at that, I want aspirational bodies. I know I've got a fat tummy, but I don't want to see one. And I was rather shocked by this. I thought, is that still the general image of women, of hatred of our own bodies? And how is it that in a society that's diversifying, that's perhaps becoming more tolerant in general, we're back in this clench of what we should look like?
I don't think we're back in a clench. I think we're in an exaggerated, accelerated clench, which affects all women, all girls. So I think it's a new phenomena that women, I don't know this program, but I have heard of it, would feel it's okay to comment on somebody else, that kind of scathing attack towards another woman is about the problem of not being able to get the body that you're supposed to get. And therefore, if you can see a body that somehow is also imperfect but is a public body, then you have a right to dump all of your rage and envy and confusion about the body. Because I think what the difference in the last, since when you probably read Fifi in the last 30 years, is that visual culture has entered our mind in an entirely different way. And
well, because everything is about the image.
But we see so many images, right? We see something like 5,000 images a week of transformed bodies.
Right? And you talk about how often they're doctored in bodies.
Well,
at the airbrushed image. What you said, it was in Vogue, 144 airbrushed images. It's incredible, isn't it? So
it's
never
not
looking
just
at real
that.
Women.
It's the New York Times has a lovely little video on its website that shows it's got I've forgotten what his name is, the person who fixed the photo. So he said there isn't one image that hasn't gone back between the art director and him and the publishing director that isn't touched 200 times. That's not one image.
Each image 200 times.
And I could not believe it, but he says it. Now, the question is, why are we even using bodies in the first place when we're fixing those bodies dramatically?
We could just invent bodies. Yeah. We don't even need real people.
Yeah, because they bear no relation. None of the women, and if you look at The men's magazines, it's exactly the same now. It's much more shocking because we see them in men's magazines and we don't even notice it in women's magazines. But none of those models would be able to recognize themselves.
So it's now becoming a problem for men as well as for women?
Yeah, but I think you have to look, as you said, you have to look commercially. It's far too profitable to destabilize bodies for the industry not to take advantage of selling this to men. And they certainly sell it to young men. It's a very, very big... It's a growing industry for them, not just cosmetics, plastic surgery, clothing. The whole presentation of self is encouraging men to look at themselves from the outside and evaluate themselves negatively, as women have been encouraged to do.
And I know you're very anti-diet. I think everybody here does know that Susie's very anti-diet. And indeed, I said to you at one point that maybe about 10 years ago when I was very depressed, I realised that I put on maybe a stone, and I thought, I have to deal with my depression, but also want to get the weight off. You were very cross with me about that. And
I wasn't cross with the desire.
No.
Because I think the desire, how could one not feel that desire in a culture in which one is always encouraged to think that there's something wrong and that the solution is somehow to get rid of 5 pounds, 10 pounds, a stone.
I mean, it's not the solution, but if you're going to deal with the internal problems which have to be dealt with, aren't you ever tempted to slip people a few bowls of cabbage soup as well?
Never. I might give them pasta. I might give them something that tastes really good, and I might be wanting to help them really be able to risk savouring and really enjoying food rather than being in a situation where they're so terrified of it that has to be ingested without actually being experienced beyond the first couple of mouthfuls. And I might be very interested in helping them to treasure something that they have probably overridden, which is appetite and its pleasures. But I definitely would not be slipping them cabbage soup.
It's just a thought.
But I don't think that the compelling nature of the diets or whatever, the solution on every page of every magazine or newspaper, I don't think there's something wrong for feeling those are compelling, because I think that we're living in a structure in which we do think that there is a solution. We don't actually often ask what the problem is. So we're being offered solutions to all sorts of anxieties and difficulties, and the body's become a place for that form of expression. But I think part of the problem is how we belong, how we get recognized, how we get seen, how we communicate, how we get valued. I don't think it's actually about body. And I think bodies come to stand in for, if I can get this piece right, then maybe I can do the other things. There's a huge shift now where girls almost have to have the brand of the body that is okay internationally in order to do anything else.
But then that's going to be a huge problem as people begin to age, or are there these girls who buy into this early, and certainly these boys buy in? There's nothing that you can do about the problems of gravity, at least not without major surgery. But
yes, but I think it's very different for young girls, because girls of 8 or 9 are already having their photos photoshopped. So we now have baby pictures that don't exist. There are no images of who we were. Not for my generation, but for little people, because they're having teeth gaps inserted or teeth gaps closed up or dimples inserted. I mean, there are a ton of websites that will do that for you, and commercial photographers who will transform your baby, your toddler, and then there are high heels for babies now. So I think the whole thing is that there is a form of preparation which doesn't make plastic surgery the kind of horror or jump or terror for my age, because for my age it has to be sold as, this is empowerment, this is a moment of this, you can really do this for yourself, why would you deny yourself this, this is really important. It won't be for them, because by the time they're kind of 10, 11, 12, they're already imagining the kind of body that will be constructed for them by the plastic surgeon. And indeed at 16, it is not, this is before they finish growing, it's not unusual in North America and South America, from the middle classes, for breast reconstructions to be occurring at that age, or labiaplasties. That's the latest phase. You probably don't even know what that is.
I do. I was just imagining it, thinking it's too early in the morning to think about labial plasty.
We don't have to talk about bodies.
I haven't had time for breakfast or anything. It's just,
But I suppose what I'd like to throw back to you, Jeanette, is so there's gravity. Mm. So what is it? You're a writer. You're an important writer. You're an important thinker. Would you have a sense of your writing capacities being diminished by experience and age?
No, not at all. I feel rather like Dame Edna. Did you hear on the radio the other day? She said she was going to Brazil to get some crow's feet put in. She just looked too young and she's causing such envy in other women. She was going to have a regressive reconstructive surgery. I think for writers, there's huge freedom there. I mean, I feel huge freedom there. I think often you do, if your powers do diminish, it's not particularly or physically, it's not a physical situation, it's usually an emotional blockage. And that's the thing to watch if you're doing creative work of any kind, because it's a place where you can't lie to yourself or to others. I think that creating something is a kind of lie detector in itself, and it asks that you don't lie, and that's why it offers itself as a kind of truth place to other people, a place where things can be discovered. There's no, you can't get away with anything in creative work.
Yeah,
you know, in society,
I think that's
that cuts
true.
Corners, that's not the place you can do it. So if you have an emotional blockage there, or there's something that you're not facing, I think the reason why a lot of writers do get washed up and crack up and kill themselves, suicide, drugs, drink a lot, isn't because they're crazy and they're depressed and that goes with the territory. It's because they come to some place which either has to be faced or it will wreck the self.
Exactly. So from the perspective, I would say this from the perspective of being a psychoanalyst and a writer, and I would ask you, the solution is not some kind of plastic surgery of the mind, right? The gravity issue is actually there's something grave going on here, which is one needs to continue to engage. Mm. That I see people who are kind of around your age, or a little bit younger maybe, who've had success and have to struggle with the problems of what that success means in terms of their work as actors or writers or scientists, what that then opens up for them and the scary territories that they then have to engage with.
Mm. I think without that engagement, the work gradually becomes plasticized in some way, or it does begin to lie, and then it's of no use to yourself or to anybody else. But it's a frightening thing to keep pushing it forward, because it's much easier, especially if you do have some success, to allow yourself to be rigid in a way which is completely unhelpful. You know, I don't have to write anything anymore. I could spend the rest of my life going around to conferences and speaking in places and feeling pleased with myself and getting very smug, being without value. And I think to push that aside, especially in a world which commodifies everything and wants you to be a product, and to say, no, I need to be at home, I need to be doing this work, I need to throw it away, I need to just be on my own, is quite difficult, because we're always meant to be out there. We're not meant to be on our own, even when we're writers. We're always meant to be doing something. But you can't do creative work unless you're being something, which is completely different.
Yeah, okay, so if I'm going to make the link with the first bit of this conversation, your very mention of gravity makes me think that you've been tempted and seduced by the kind of cultural mix in which we think that is something terrible. But in fact, when we're talking about...
In gravity, as in, your boobs needing their own pair
exactly.
of shoes. That kind of thing. Well, they do get lower, don't they? You think,
or
what can I do for you?
A different, form, of course, a different form of brassiere, I think, is it's very interesting that you would reject that notion with your mind, that what you don't want in your mind is to have the rigidity. You actually want the challenge of the flexibility and the risk of having earned what you've understood.
Yeah. And I don't believe in the mind-body split. I think it's forced on us. I don't think it's actual. I don't think it's real. I don't think it's integral to being a human being that there's a mind-body split. And I think it's something that needs to be rejected. But that can't be in an arbitrary way. It has to. I think that was also part of the work of a lifetime. That although my body isn't entirely me, I am in this body, and when this body goes, I go too. So it's important, I think, to live in that total place rather than in a separated place.
Am I allowed to ask you what you mean, that your body is not entirely you? You mean you're not limited to your body? Is that what you meant to say? Or you meant you weren't in the right body?
No, I'm not divorced from it. No, it's mine, and I like it. I don't want anybody else's body. I want this one. And I love it through its various changes. But I'm also aware, as I think we all are from time to time, that the mind stretches beyond and past that, as it does all space-time conditions. All the mind is not a bounded condition, mm-hmm. which is what's so exciting. But this is our home, this is where we live, you know, this is the body, this is the place of contact, of reality, of relationship. And without it, there really isn't anything, not that I can find. Mm-hmm. You're doing very well this morning, concentrating on all of this. But I think if people have creativity, whatever, I don't know if Susie agrees with this or not, but I don't think that some people are creative and some people aren't. I think that there is a creative continuum in which we all live, but I think that there are different doses and dilutions of creativity, and in some people it's very strong and it's very urgent, in other people it's less so. But it's present for everybody, and in that creative place is necessary for our mental and emotional and I think physical well-being, that life should have meaning and that human beings are naturally creative and inventive in that full sense. We want to understand our world, we want to remake our world, we want to be creative in our relationships. It's not simply enough to say this is for one set of people and the rest are consumers. It isn't a producer-consumer relationship, which is why in itself it stands as a rebuke to a society which is entirely constructed around producer-consumer relationships. So creativity itself is always rebuking that very reductive method mode of understanding ourselves and our world, which is why it needs to be encouraged, I think, and why it offers great freedom for all of us. It doesn't matter, you don't have to be Tolstoy or Virginia Woolf or David Mitchell, or you just have to be able to be in the place where creativity can happen in your life, and I think that's very freeing. I think it's when people live these meaningless, robotic, constructed lives that the problems start, and they often then, as you say, are put into food, so food becomes the problem and the solution. As you say, in bodies, it can never be that.
While you were talking, I was thinking about a play I saw last night, The Pit and Painters, and this is about a mining community that, in the 30s, that invited somebody from the Workers' Education Association to come and teach them art appreciation. And because they didn't have the references for the pictures that he was showing, he gets them to paint. And so it's the story of what happens to these miners, the pitmen, from the mid-30s to the beginning of the Labour government, post-war Labour government. And actually the enterprise went on until the 80s. And I suppose part of what's being discussed in that play is what you're talking about in terms of dilutions, the capacity of people to enter into something that extends them, expresses them, allows them to engage with their world. Because what's very clear in this play is that these are miners who have the most extraordinary skill for their own craft. That actually there's an art in their craft because it's dangerous, it's about fellowship, it's about thoughtfulness in terms of what they actually have to do. And they're enthusiastic learners and they want to learn something. They think they should learn economics, but they somehow end up with art appreciation and they end up with painting. And it's part of the dialogue and part of the playwright's discussion is about what is creativity? What is art? Are they all potential geniuses, or is this a form of expression, a way of reflecting on yourself, a way of entering into life in a different kind of way? And I thought also beautiful was to revive something that is lost in our culture. We may have it in school. We may have the notion that kids should have music and they should have drama and they should have art. But actually, I'm not sure that it's presented to kids in a way that allows them necessarily to take it up. It's sort of just the slack period in class for an awful lot of people. I don't know why I was thinking that, but I was thinking about the kind of vision we had was abounded, maybe when you were growing up, Jeanette, which made it possible for you to imagine outside of your Pentecostal background, made it possible for you to think not just in the grand scheme of God, but in the grand scheme of creativity, because it was part of the post-war settlement that we could all be artists, we could all be contributing in that kind of way.
And I think that got lost in a fake democracy, that somehow, if art's not for everybody, it's elitist, but it is for everybody. When people say it isn't, I think all you can do is say, look at every child that's ever born. It's completely obvious. There's no child doesn't want to. You give it an instrument, it starts to play, it'll bang a drum, it wants to listen to stories, the child wants to make up stories, the child wants to paint pictures, the child wants to sing songs, he or she wants to act out little dramas. That urge for creativity, for expressing the world symbolically, enthusiastically, happens straight away, and we knock it out of them. And then when we've finally beaten art and creativity out of kids, we say, see, not everybody wants it, it's elitist, it's only for a few of you. It's such a lie, because it's there from the very beginning. It's just an evidence-based observation. It's not that art and creativity is something that's made up by a kind of elite when they didn't have anything better to do on a wet Sunday afternoon and they were a leisured class who didn't have to work for them. It's complete nonsense, you know.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I was thinking that where we're sitting is the Roundhouse, which of course was part of Wesker's vision of bringing, of remaking art in the 60s and making it accessible again in a way that it hadn't been because of elitism.
And Thatcher was very bad for that, I agree. As a child of Thatcher, I think there were good things and bad things.
Yeah. But I was thinking this, if we could just for 2 minutes maybe think about, I'm very aware that we're in a time slot here.
Yeah, we haven't heard our gong yet.
Oh, okay.
I used to work at the Roundhouse. It's very strange for me to be back here because I would be, when I left Oxford, this was my first job, opening shows on a Saturday morning for kids and doing front of house, and here I am again. Little known fact.
I think what I was thinking, I don't know if there's a question or if there's just a comment in here or whether I'm just going back to something we've already said, which is about creativity and everybody's capacities to engage with the world and to try to remake it and not repeat it. But the struggle, do you think the Sunday painter, okay, let me ask it this way, do you think the Sunday painter has to struggle to break free, or do you think that they get into a kind of repetitive form where it moves away from the process of creation? Because, you know, you obviously have... Well, I'm sure you've had creative writing classes, so...
What?
No, you've given them. You've had loads of students in creative writing classes.
No, I haven't. I've never... I don't do them. I think you might as well clean out the cesspit.
Right, so you don't see people...
This conversation won't go anywhere on this.
Okay, all right, okay.
No, I don't think... I think creative writing classes have limited use. And probably that if you want to understand how to write, all you need to do is get the stuff off the shelves to find somebody who's better than you, which is not difficult. And then it's all in there. But that's my creative writing class approach is a whole world apart, which we shouldn't go to now. But I think... that for people wanting to create, it doesn't matter whether you're writing poems, whether you're doing your painting, whether you're playing the piano for your own pleasure, whether you're in a garage band. It's important, I think, that all of us engage not just as in a passive way, but also in an active way with our own creativity. However that's expressed, it might be doing the garden, it could be anything, but it's really important that it's not passive because this culture is far too passive. And too much about receiving things rather than just giving things out from yourself in a way which is really about you. And I think that creativity is never passive, and so to have it in your life in any shape or form gives you back a sense of control, a sense of self-respect, and also just a sense of exhilarating freedom, that you are who you are and you have some, and that you have some self-definition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's really interesting that in your... because I'm going to be talking to a scientist right after this.
Yeah.
And I think it's quite interesting the way we're talking about creativity leaves out that whole practice.
No, it doesn't. But they can do that after I've gone. Dan will know more about it than I do.
Yeah, no, but I think there is still a two cultures divide where our notions of what constitutes cultural engagement and creativity still exclude practices of scientists, even though in your own work you have endeavoured, it seems to me, to come to grips with quite a bit of physics and quite a bit of cosmology.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by science, but I think, you know,
And so, I think you would recognise it as an act of creation.
Of course, but I also think that for most people now, science is very difficult to understand, and that's quite a relatively new development.
Yeah, it's a 20th century phenomenon.
Yeah, so we have to believe what we're told, which is disturbing because we can't work it out for ourselves.
And we don't have the phenomena of the science critic at all. We have a literary critic, we have movie critics, we have dance critics. Mm. We do not have science critics.
But I think Dan will be able to talk about that, but I can't because it's not my territory.
No, but what I'm talking about in this is the fact that we don't even imagine that there are people who could actually challenge the gee-whizzery in the way that we do with literature. We know that literature is so-and-so is promoted, and there are people saying, no, but I don't think this is right. I think this isn't right. But we don't have that in other fields. That's all, which I think is interesting.
No, I think that's true. But that's because we do also live in a culture that tries to split everything off and put everything into little sections, and it's difficult always to cross those boundaries, as our education system is so dire. So if children are taught at all, they're taught things in packages and sections. They're not taught how things might join up and how exciting that might be. And when you go back into, you look back at earlier science, you find some very, you know, very exciting combinations. You know, there's the story of Coleridge and Priestley, and Coleridge just gets high on laughing gas because Priestley's firing it about the laboratory. And from that, he goes off and writes The Ancient Mariner, because he's in a completely other state. And you know, there are wonderful images in there of the sea snakes' luminescence, which they were just beginning to understand. So all of that is brought in. And I think writers do use all of that. I mean, we may not use it in a way which is fully understanding, but we can use it as a way of expanding our vision and the vision of those people who are then coming and reading the stuff. Yeah. So I think there is an integration possible, even though there isn't a full understanding possible anymore.
You said something interesting there that it's about connections, and I wondered whether that's what you like when you're writing, is that a connection comes to you that you hadn't seen before.
Yeah, I mean, everybody knows Ian Forster's Only Connect, and I think the idea of relation, in a relational world, I mean, we've talked about that world, this is all in relationship to, rather than a static world, where there's me and there's stuff that's not me. But the dynamic between them is what's really interesting, and I think if you're doing creative work, it is probably those relationships that you make, however bizarre.
Well, can I talk for a minute about the relationship between writing and psychoanalysis?
Yeah.
Because I think for the psychoanalyst and the analysand, or the two people involved in that endeavour, what's interesting is the surprise, the what isn't known, the what emerges between the two of you, that it's not a surgical procedure. There isn't the shrink with the interpretation telling the patient. It's actually what develops in the relationship, both at the level of feeling, but also at the level of ideas and what comes up, what pops up, what doesn't fit. And to me, the practice of writing is not so different than the practice of doing therapy.
Well, it shouldn't be. There should be that element of surprise. I think if you're not surprising yourself as a writer, you may as well do something else.
Well, yeah, I'm interested in that because you have to have some notion of what you're up to. But
yeah.
Right? So there's got to be a tension between where you think you're going and where you have to surrender to what happens when you're in the process.
And I think it's in that book you lent me, which is about the unthought known, which I love as an idea. The thing that, well, it says I don't need to explain it, do I? But it's the thing that you do know, but you've never thought about till that moment. And then, but it has a kind of clarity and recognition to it when you do think of it, which makes you feel.
Or when it's named.
Yeah, or when it's named, but preferably by yourself rather than somebody else. I think those discoveries, those self-discoveries and those discoveries that then connect to something outside of the self are really valuable. It's being able to continue with that process brings back to what we were saying earlier. I think that both keeps you alive as a human being and allows you to go on developing until you actually drop dead rather than just having received everything as it seems and then using all of that for the rest of your life and having nothing new added to it, which is the huge danger and the great sadness, I think, that people just get stuck in a place.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting about the practice of psychoanalysis or psychotherapy is that one is continually engaged with being wrong-footed. Mm. And it's the wrong-footedness that allows you to think new thoughts. It isn't the logical, procedural conversation. It's because you end up somewhere that's a bit wobbly, and that makes for a new potential space for the individuals in the room to be in and to think in. And I don't know...
It's the wobble, that's for sure. You can't, if you're on solid ground, you're probably in trouble.
Well, I suppose, the clinician, you've got to be on some solid ground, because otherwise, and you've got to provide enough solid ground so that there can be the flexibility of affect and mind that you're talking about. But I think it's probably different because you have the confidence of being a writer who knows that they can do the thing that they can do the writing. The question is, what does that mean? Middle sentence?
That's 5 minutes.
It's 5 minutes. Okay.
It's a terrible thing, isn't it? You don't want to say anything at all then. You're completely silent. It's like those exam situations where you've only written half an answer and you know that you've got 5 minutes
actually
left.
Actually, now I think they just do bullet points, don't they? But since they're marked on bullet points and they're not marked on a narrative, or that would be
what
fine.
You,
so shall we
think?
Have a few bullet points?
Well, I want you to ask Dan why we're so concerned with making computers, machines ever more sensitive, flexible, competent, surprising, able, while we're busy reducing human beings to their lowest possible common denominator, where they're a set of bullet points. Well, how did that happen? How do we spend billions of pounds making machines more sensitive and nothing at all on doing the same for human beings?
Well, I'm not sure I know what you mean there, but isn't something about bullet points are a form of...
I mean, it's a good idea to
it's a form
teach
of clarity.
To conceptualise thought rather than to...
No, but that isn't what
boxes.
The bullet points are in exams. Yeah. I've seen the A-level examiners talk to, I don't know how many thousands of students at Central Hall Westminster and telling them exactly how to get their A's.
Yeah, which is pathetic.
Which is you need three of these and six of those and three of these and six of those. Doesn't matter what the language is like, you just need these points. Mm. Now, I don't know where... I think that's because Britain moved into... How did we get to education? Britain moved into multiple-choice exams that look narrative, right? In America, you just tick the boxes. You're basically ticking the box here, except you have to make the sentences, which I think must be so horrible for teachers. It must be so horrible for teachers who went into the profession to open minds, to have that experience of what they're having to convey.
We need to throw all that out and we need to get art back into schools.
We need to get thinking back into schools.
Thinking would be good, wouldn't it? Thinking would be good. That would be a change.
I think the whole move to have philosophy for children in primary schools is just fantastic. I think, of course, I would say this, having been part of the inception of something called Antidote and emotional literacy, I think getting emotional literacy for staff and students, little kids, so that they actually learn to name their emotional words as much as they can do arithmetic and spelling is absolutely crucial.
And not to be embarrassed about thinking. I was in the garden yesterday thinking in the Cotswolds, and the postman came and he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm thinking." He looked at me, he said, "Have you got time to do that?" Genuine bafflement. That's my job. But there is also, there is that moment, and even I have it, there's a point where you think, Jesus, should I be, it's this doing being, should I be doing something? Actually, I'm just sitting here and I'm thinking about everything I want to think about. But I'm not doing anything, so I appear
not to
be a producer.
No, but that is very active. This being doing split, which actually was psychoanalyst Winnicott's, one of his big shticks, which we, I could talk about if we didn't just have the gong.
But we're in particular feel guilty about. They're always doing. They think, I better just wash up.
Yeah, but I think what's
that's what I mean about the difference between being and doing. Just giving yourself the space not to do apparently anything.
But I'm not sure that's how it works for women, because I think actually while they're in the doing, they are quite actively in the being. I think the way femininity has come to be, and the sense that what you have to do is provide and do and produce for others. Mm. It would be very hard to do the being outside of that structure. You have to kind of sneak it in. And so that doing becomes the valve within which, or the structure in which you do the thing. So I think you're being a little idealist about being able to sit there and being. You know, I certainly don't think that's an easy accomplishment for people at this particular moment in history.
No, it isn't, but I think it might be worth protecting.
Yeah, but
you might need an endangered part of the self that needs.
I don't think it's endangered. I think it's there.
Special food.
Sorry?
Special food in a habitat. Like a giant panda.
Yeah, I think I might think of it more behaviourally as daring to take that kind of space on even just a couple of minutes at a time, because I don't actually think people could just surrender to it. I think it'd be quite difficult.
Do you think we should start thinking in 2-minute sections?
No, but I think...
Yes.
Oh, goodbye. Okay, goodbye.